This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents A Conspiracy of Bones by Kathy Reichs. Read by Linda Emond.
For Carolyn Reedy and Kevin Hansen, you never stopped believing in me. It is far harder to kill a phantom than a reality. Virginia Woolf, The Death of the Moth and Other Essays. Chapter 1. Friday, June 22nd. Reactions to pressure vary. Some people are ductile, able to stretch. Others are brittle, powerless to bend. Physicists talk of stress-strain curves. One thing is certain. If the burden is too great, or the loading too rapid, anyone can snap. I know. I reached my breaking point the summer after my boss was murdered. Moi, the igneous rock of emotion. And I'm not talking about just the nightmares. To be fair, Larrabee's death wasn't the immediate or sole trigger. There was Andrew Ryan, my longtime lover and cop partner in investigating homicides in Quebec. Succumbing to pressure, I'd agreed to cohabitate with Ryan on both the Montreal and Charlotte ends of our geographically complex relationship. There was Katie's posting in Afghanistan, Mama's cancer, Pete's news about Boyd, my diagnosis, then surgery, the migraines. A world of stressors was chafing my personal curve. Looking back, I admit I spun out of orbit. Perhaps going rogue was an attempt to steer unsteerable forces, a bird flip to aging, to the renegade vessel threatening havoc in my brain. Perhaps it was a cry for Ryan's attention, a subconscious effort to drive him away. Or maybe it was just the goddamn Carolina heat. Who knows? I was holding my own until the faceless man sent me over the edge. His remains and the subsequent investigation punched a black hole in my smug little world. My mother spotted the changes long before the enigmatic corpse turned up. The distractedness, the agitation, the short temper. She blamed it all on the aneurysm. From the moment of its discovery, Mama was convinced the little bubble would burst and my own blood would take me out. I scoffed at her critique of my behavior, knowing she was right. I was ignoring emails, the phone, declining invitations in favor of solo binging on old Hollywood flicks. Hell, I'd watched my favorite Annie Hall 4 times. I didn't tell Mama about the nighttime visitations, twisting montages filled with dark figures and vague dangers, or frustrating tasks I couldn't complete. Anxiety? Hormones? The headache meds I was forced to ingest? Irrelevant, the root of my irritability. I was sleeping little, constantly restless, and exhausted. It didn't take Freud to recognize I was in a bad place. So there I was, wide awake in the wee hours, talking myself down from a dream about a storm and snakes and Larrabee sealed in a body bag. Old Sigmund might have offered a comment on that. I tried deep breathing, a relaxation exercise starting with my toes. No sale. Nerves on edge, I got up and crossed to the window. 2 floors below, the ground spread out around my townhouse, dark and still, save for the lank twisting of a leaf in the occasional half-hearted breeze. I was turning away when my eyes caught a flicker of movement beside the pine on my neighbor's front lawn. Peering hard, I made out a silhouette. Bulky. Male? On the grounds of Sharon Hall at midnight? Heart pumping a bit faster, I blinked to refocus. The silhouette had blended into the shadows. Had someone actually been there? Curious, I pulled on a pair of discarded shorts and my Nikes and went downstairs,
I wasn't planning to confront the guy, if there was a guy. I just wanted to determine his reason for being outside my home at that hour. In the kitchen, I switched off the alarm and slipped out the back door onto my terrace. The weather was beyond Dixie summer night warm, the air hot and muggy, the leaves as droopy and discouraged as they'd appeared from upstairs. Spotting no prowler, I circled the building. Still, no one. I set off on one of the paths crisscrossing the estate. It had rained as I'd eaten my microwave pizza dinner at 10, and moisture still hung thick in the air. Puddles glistened black on the gravel, went yellow as my fuzzy shadow and I passed under quaint-as-hell carriage lights blurred by mist. The tiny pond was a dark void, woolly where the water met the bank. Murky shapes glided its surface, silent, aware of their tenuous state. The Homeowners Association fights an endless, often creative battle. No matter the deterrent, the geese always return. I was passing a black Lego form I knew to be a small gazebo when I sensed, more than heard, another presence. I stopped, stared. A man was standing in the smear of shadow within the gazebo. His face was down, his features obscured. Medium height and build, I could tell little else about him, except two things. First, I didn't know him. He wasn't a resident, and I'd never seen him visit. Second, despite the stifling heat, the man was wearing a trench coat. When he raised an arm, perhaps to check a watch, the fabric flashed pale in the gloom enveloping him. I glanced nervously over my shoulder. Crap, why hadn't I brought my phone? Easy one there, because the damn thing was dead, again. Fine, why hadn't I at least lit the porch light? Go home and call 311 to report a prowler? 911? I turned back. The gazebo was empty. I checked in both directions along the path, to the right, the left. The man wasn't on it. The mist began to morph back into rain. Listless drops tested for foothold on my face and hair. Time to head in. Suddenly, beyond the circle drive, I caught a wink of gray. There, then gone. Shot of adrenaline. Was Trenchcoat targeting me? Casing the layout of Sharon Hall? If not, what was he doing here, in the rain, in the middle of the night? And why so elusive? Or was my wariness a product of paranoia? Another gift from my overburdened stress-strain curve. Either way, I was glad I'd left pepper spray in my shorts pocket after my previous run. Perhaps roused by the unsettling dream, images of Larrabee's last moments unspooled in my head. The gray-green pallor of his skin. The eerie glow of the surgical trauma ICU. The impartial pinging of the monitors recording their bloodless peaks and valleys. The screaming silence when the pinging stopped. Later, in an interview room smelling of sweat and fear, the slouchy indifference of the brain-fried tweaker who'd sent the bullets into my longtime boss's belly. Stop. Aloud, or just in my mind? I lengthened my stride, footfalls crunching softly in the stillness. A full minute, then a trench-coated form far up where the path emptied into a residence parking area. The man was walking with an odd swinging gait, his back to me. Suddenly, noise seemed to ricochet from all around, rustling leaves, shifting branches, snapping twigs. Night creatures? Trenchcoat's geeked-out pals looking to fund more meth? I had no valuables, carried no money, wore no watch. Would that anger them? Or were the sounds the invention of overwrought nerves? I patted the pepper spray at my right hip. Felt the canister, pink and nasty. A molecule of the price I'd paid had been donated toward breast cancer research. Momentary indecision. Head home? Continue on the path and observe the man? Confront him in the parking lot. There were street lamps there, overwhelmed but trying their best. I slowed. Trenchcoat was now just 10 yards ahead. My brain chose that moment to unreel a blockbuster tableau. When I approached, the man would pull a knife and try to slit my throat. Jesus, Why was I letting this guy fluster me? In my line of work, I encounter far worse than a dude dressed like Bogey in Casablanca. Outlaw bikers who chainsaw the heads and hands from their murdered rivals. Macho pricks who stalk and strangle their terrified exes. Drunken bullies who wall slam fussy infants. Those lowlifes don't dissuade me from focusing on my job. Quite the reverse, they inspire me to work harder. So why the drama over a man in a belted coat? Why the sense of threat? It was doubtful the guy was a psycho. More likely a harmless geezer overly sensitive to damp. Either way, I owed it to my neighbors to find out. I'd use the hedge as cover and follow him for a while. If he acted suspicious, I'd go inside and dial the cops. Let them decide. I wriggled through a gap in the bushes, moved along their far side a few yards, then paused to scan the parking lot. The man was there, standing under one of the struggling lamps. His chin was raised, his features vaguely discernible as dark blotches on a smudgy white rectangle. My breath froze. The guy was staring straight at me. Or was he? Unnerved, I pivoted to search for the opening in the shrubbery at my back, couldn't find it, dived in where the darkness seemed less dense. The tunnel was narrow, barely there or not there at all. Twigs and leaves snagged my arms and hair, skeletal fingers clawing me back. My breathing sounded louder, more desperate, as though fighting entrapment by the thick vegetation. The air was heavy with the scent of wet bark, damp earth, and my own perspiration. A few feet, then I was free, and hurrying back toward the pond. Not the way I'd come, a new route, more shadowed, less open. Imperceptibly, a new odor entered the olfactory mix. A familiar odor. An odor that triggered a fresh wave of adrenaline. I was catching whiffs of decomposing flesh. Impossible. Yet there it was, stark and cold as the images haunting my dreams. A minute of scrambling around a stand of azaleas and philodendron, then I detected a thawing in one slice of the darkness ahead. Within the slice, angles and planes of shadow shifting and tilting out on the lawn. Trenchcoat's minions lying in wait? I was almost to the edge of the garden when a rip-your-face-off snarl brought me up short. As my mind struggled to form a rational explanation, a high-pitched scream sent every hair on my arms and neck upright. Handshaking, I pulled the pepper spray from my pocket and inched forward. Beyond the shrubs, out where the lawn met the eastern wall of the property, two dogs were locked in winner-take-all combat. The larger, the scraggy consequence of some lab pit bull affair, was all hackles, bared teeth, and gleaming white sclera. The smaller, probably a terrier, cowered tense and timorous, blood and spit matting the fur on one haunch. Neither animal was familiar to me. Unaware of my presence or not caring, the lab pit braced, then lunged for another attack. The terrier yelped and tried to flatten itself even more to the ground, desperate to reduce the amount of mass it presented to the world. The lab pit held a moment, then, confident that rank had been established, pivoted and trotted toward a dark mound lying at the base of the wall. As the terrier slunk off, tail curled to its belly, the lab pit sniffed the air, scanned its surroundings, then lowered its head. I watched, spellbound, curious about the cause of the fight. A flurry of thrashing and tugging, then the victor's snout rose. Clamped in the dog's jaw was the severed head of a goose. Ravaged neck glistening black, cheeks swathed, winking white like the smile of an evil clown. I watched rain fall on the bird's sightless eye. Chapter 2. Friday, June 29th. A week passed, almost to the minute. Nothing much happened. Freaked by the dueling dogs and murdered goose, I hadn't reported the intruder, or peeper, or whatever he was. Never saw him again. I'd hit a rough patch of late. Health-wise, personally, professionally. The last, self-inflicted. I could have been more diplomatic, or kept my mouth shut. Who knew my comments would come back to bite me in the ass? Right. Don't they always? Mostly, I focused on those problems. And seriously, a prowler in a trench coat? Was that not the oldest cliché in the book? Had the man been there at all? Or was the whole incident an aftershock of my migraine-induced nightmare? A pair of fuzzy orbs congealed into headlights that drilled my car's rear window. The interior brightened, nudging my thoughts back from wherever they'd been. 11:10 p.m. I'd just dropped Mama at her new digs and was stopped on Sharon Amity at the intersection with Providence Road. While waiting for a green, I peeked at myself in the rearview mirror. Hair knotted at the nape of my neck. Not great, but okay. Remnants of mascara, blush, and gloss gamely trying to mask the exhaustion. Mama hadn't commented. Or had she? I'd paid little attention. Silk tunic, a little bohemian, but not over the top. Couldn't see the black skinny jeans, baggier these days. Tory Burch sandals. I stop for red toes. The outfit, the L'Oreal, the Opie polish. I was making an effort. Re-engaging with the world, as Mama would say. Did say, repeatedly, between checking to see if my pupils were equal. Mahler's Symphony No. 2 in C minor tonight. Resurrection. Ironic. I couldn't wait to get home. Don't get me wrong, I enjoy the concerts, but I rank the post-performance cocktail clutches with Mama's friends on par with a colonoscopy. Though, in fairness, the old up yours confers a health benefit. My mother, Catherine Deasie Daisy Lee Brennan, is a widow with cancer and a boyfriend who spends his weekdays running a dry-cleaning empire out of its Arkansas headquarters. My sister, Harry, lives 1,000 miles away in Texas, and is crazy. You get the picture. I'm usually Mama's default date, which is fine. But why agree to the Opry Theater gatherings? Simple. My mother elevates the art of passive-aggressive to previously unimagined heights, and I always cave. The traffic signal changed. I accelerated. The headlights behind me shrank, winged left. Sharon Amity became Sharon Lane. No reason. Ahead, Sharon Lane would T-bone into Sharon Road. Confusing street names are Charlotte's way of messing with out-of-town drivers. Shadows skipped across the windshield as I passed under a lattice of willow oaks arching high overhead. Snatches of the evening's conversation replayed in my head. The same tired conversations as always. Your mother looks great. Meaning, not dead. The chemo is going well. How's Pete? I heard your ex is dating a hot yoga instructor, a brain surgeon, the heiress to an international shipping line. He's good, thanks. Our prayers are with Katie.
Thank God it's your kid in a war zone, not ours.
She's good, thanks.
My nephew just finalized his divorce and is moving to Charlotte. You two must meet.
Let me rescue you from your pathetic life.
I'm good, thanks. Tonight, new topics had entered in, queries inspired by my current fiasco.
Are you still teaching at UNCC? Are you being forced to fall back on your day job?
A few graduate courses? Dr. Larrabee's death was a terrible tragedy.
It was. How do you like the current ME? Rumor has it you're embroiled in a shitstorm with your new boss.
Excuse me, I think Daisy is signaling that she'd like to leave. These sessions made me wish I still drank. A lot. I crossed Wendover. The road narrowed to 2 lanes. I hit a speed bump. The car bucked, dropped. My iPhone lit up. No chime. I'd had it on silent during the concert, forgotten to flick the little lever. I glanced down to where the mobile lay on the passenger seat. A gray box indicated a received text. I figured it was Mama, concerned my embolization had blown, or that I'd been kidnapped by Somali pirates. Minutes later, parked in my drive, I tapped the screen and flicked to the Messages app. The text had arrived at 8:34. I opened the app, the message. 4 images. A frisson of current sparked under my sternum. My townhouse was blessedly cool and smelled faintly of plaster and fresh paint. Birdie? Tossing my keys onto the counter. No response. I'm home, bird. Nothing. The cat was still pissed about the renovations. Fine, I had my own issues. I locked the door, set the alarm, and crossed the kitchen without turning on a light. Passing through the dining room and then the parlor, I climbed the stairs. 19th-century deeds refer to the tiny two-story structure as the annex. Annex to what? No living soul has a clue. To the mansion? Now condos presiding over the grounds of Sharon Hall? To the converted carriage house beside it? I don't give a rat's ass. I've lived in the annex's Lilliputian rooms for more than a decade since my separation from the would-be swain of the shipping line heiress. Throughout my tenancy, I'd changed nothing but light bulbs. Until recently. And the process, building codes, permits, homeowners association hysteria, had been horrendous. And still there were issues. Jammed windows. A lunatic electrician, a no-show painter. Reaching the top tread, I glanced right toward the door leading into the new square footage. As usual, my chest tightened just a hiccup, enough to get my attention. The same flinch experienced by victims of home invasion? I'd made the decision to live with Ryan. We'd agreed to shift between cities, commute as work demanded and freedom allowed. We'd bought a condo in Montreal. I'd agreed to construction of the addition here. Enough space for a roomie. So why the mental cringe? Why the refusal to actually move into the space? Nothing more fearsome than bad wiring and the wrong shade of gray lay beyond the door. 2 desks, 2 bookshelves, 2 filing cabinets. 2 toothbrushes in the bathroom. 2 kinds of bread in the freezer. Everything in pairs. My life subdivided. I'd been there. It hadn't worked out. Get a grip, Brennan. Ryan's not Pete. He'll never betray you. He's handsome, smart, generous, kind, and sexy as hell. Why the reluctance to commit? As usual, I had no answer. In the bedroom, I threw my purse onto the bureau, myself into the rocker, and kicked off the sandals. Then I plugged in my phone so the damn thing wouldn't die within seconds. I view crime scene and autopsy pics all the time. They're never pretty. The ashen flesh, the unseeing eyes, the blood-spattered walls or car interiors. Though I'm accustomed, the sad tableaus always affect me, the stark reminders that a human life has ended violently. These hit me harder than most. I swallowed. The first image showed a man lying supine in a body bag, arms straight and tight to his sides. The bag had been unzipped to his waist. I could see nothing beyond his rolled sleeves and belt. The man had died in a blood-soaked écru shirt. A pair of shoes was tucked by his head, made of the same rich brown leather that had held up his pants. Above the bloody collar, the man's face was a horror show of macerated flesh and bone. The nose and ears were gone, the orbits dark and empty, sightless as the dead goose by the garden wall. The grim flashback elicited another visceral shudder. The next two images were close-ups of the man's hands, or would have been had either survived. His forearms were mangled from the elbows down, the radii and ulni ended in jagged projections below the point to which the creamy sleeves had been rolled. Severed tendons glistened white in the hamburger mash. The last image zeroed in on the man's midsection. The shirt front had been displaced to one side. His abdomen gaped wide below ribs resembling the bleached wreckage of a boat's shattered bow. What remained of his viscera was almost unrecognizable. I spotted a few organ remnants, some threads of liver and spleen. Nothing positioned where it should have been. The message was tagged with no name or number, filtered through a spam-like phone exchange. I knew there were apps and websites that would accommodate a texter's desire for anonymity, tricks to hide one's identity using throwaway email accounts. But who would do that, and why? And who would have access to such a mangled corpse, to my mobile number? Joe Hawkins? Such a breach of protocol seemed way out of character. Joe was the oldest death investigator at the Mecklenburg County Medical Examiner's Office. Oldest in every sense. Hawkins was stitching Y's when the MCME had a single pathologist and one assistant. Probably when Custer went down at the Little Bighorn. If the sender was Hawkins, what was his motive? Yeah, the Vic was a mess, but we'd both seen worse, much worse. Was Hawkins an ally in my current conflict? A neutral, leaking intel to a comrade in peril? Was Hawkins giving me a heads up? Since the faceless man would be difficult to ID, was he suggesting the case might require an anthropology consult? For years, I'd been the sole practitioner serving the region. In the past, the task would unquestionably have fallen to me. Until Larrabee was killed, and Marco Hefner stepped into his scrubs. Word of explanation. Since North Carolina has a statewide medical examiner system, the hiring decision was made by the chief ME in Chapel Hill. The Mecklenburg County Medical Examiner's Office, the facility for which I consult, is one of several subsidiary offices and serves the five counties surrounding Charlotte. Thanks to trigger-friendly gun laws, my fellow state citizens shoot one another with glorious enthusiasm. Therefore, following Larrabee's murder, the chief needed a replacement fast. The salary isn't stratospheric, so Hefner had been one of only a handful of applicants. From her perspective, Charlotte's climate dazzled in comparison to that of North Dakota. From the state's perspective, she was willing to work cheap and start right away. Bingo! Dr. Margot Hefner, forensic pathologist, author, and showboat extraordinaire. Hefner began freezing me out the minute she landed. No pretense at subtlety. From day one, she made it clear that hiring Charlie Manson would be preferable to working with me. You guessed it. There's history between us. 6 years back, Hefner published a book titled Death's Avenger, My Life as a Morgue Doctor. The opus, intended for a general audience, was a collection of case studies, most fairly mundane, intended to paint its creator as the greatest pathologist since the invention of the scalpel. Fair enough. Shine a light on the profession, inspire the next generation. And shine she did. For a few weeks, Hefner was everywhere. Talk shows, print, sidebar ads, social media. I was good with it. Until Dr. Morgue did a series of interviews with a right-wing sleazeball named Nick Boddy. Blogging and podcasting on the internet, and from there onto scores of AM radio stations, Boddy spews whatever trash he thinks will boost ratings and readership. Anti-vaccination, government mind control, U.S. military involvement in the Twin Towers and Beirut barracks attacks. Everything is fair game, no matter how hurtful or absurd. Ditto any sensationalized tale of violence and personal devastation. Hefner didn't restrict her conversations with Boddy to the topic of her book. In more than one, she discussed the case of a murdered child. A brutal killing for which no perp had been convicted. I definitely wasn't good with that. When asked by a journalist for my opinion of Hefner's behavior, I was sharp in my criticism. Maybe he was goading me with loaded questions. Maybe it was the fact that I was working three child homicides and feeling overly protective of victims. Maybe I was tired. Whatever the cause, I didn't hold back. Hefner was furious, threatened a lawsuit for slander or libel or whatever, but didn't follow through. The feud never went public. No one cares about the bickering of science nerds. But in our little nerd circles, the gossip was rife. That year, at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, a colleague in entomology, Paulette Youngman, advised me to let the quarrel go. Was it Dallas? Baltimore? The venue is all blur in my mind. Paulette and I were on a break from a multidisciplinary workshop on child abuse when Hefner passed in one of her signature Diane von Furstenberg raps. You're right, Youngman had said. The woman has no scruples. She discussed an open homicide to hawk her damn book. It doesn't matter. It does matter. If she's compromised the case, and there's no justice for the child. And he wasn't the only one. She talked about other missing kids. I could hear bodies salivating through the speakers. Youngman swirled the ice in her soda, then set down her styrofoam tumbler. Ever heard of Ophiocordyceps campanati balzani? I think I have a colony under my sink. It's a fungus that grows out of the heads of ants in the Brazilian rainforest. They're called zombie ants. Sounds like another crackpot body conspiracy theory. But this is true. The fungus mind controls the ants. Mind controls them into doing what? Voting Republican? It takes over the ant's brain, then kills the host once it's moved to a location suitable for fungal success. Fiendish. It's fungus. I was lost. Your point? Hevner's morality has been hijacked by a need for fame and public adulation. She's become a zombie pathologist. Youngman shrugged. So I should just let it drop? In the end, the ant always loses. Youngman tipped her head, reflecting fluorescent light off the unfashionable black glasses riding low on her nose. For a long moment, neither of us spoke. Youngman broke the silence. Did Hevener's book make the New York Times bestseller list? Not even close. I checked. Youngman grinned. I grinned back. In the intervening years, I've often thought of that conversation. Assumed the whole ant-fungus metaphor was a byproduct of viewing too many projected images of battered children. But here it was, 6 years later, and Hevener had found a location where she could flourish. Dr. Morgue was running the MCME. And I was persona non grata, my life in disarray. I looked at the clock, almost midnight. Call Hawkins? Not a chance he'd be awake. A quick toilet, and I crawled into bed. Of course, I didn't sleep. In the dark, images looped and swirled, denizens of my subconscious begging for attention. Hevner, Hawkins, the faceless man. A defect in my left posterior communicating artery now packed with tiny platinum coils. At some point, Birdie came and curled at my side. Didn't help. My mind was a hazardous waste dump of doubt, distress, and unanswered questions. Chief among them, who was the doomed ant? Who the fungus facing a prosperous future? Chapter 3. Saturday, June 30th. I was awakened by a mockingbird doing animated a cappella outside my window. Birdie was gone, presumably off resuming his snit. The clock said 6:27. The sky was easing from pewter to pearl. The room was a collision of shadows sharpening at the edges. I tried rolling over. A conversation sluiced into my drowsy brain. An old woman, voice quavery, as though uncertain of wanting her message delivered. Or terrified. I still hear the old woman's words in my head. Blood-sucking trash. Using my sweet baby's death to glorify her own self. Lord Jesus knows it's wrong. Hardin Symes. That was the dead kid's name. I later learned that the caller was Bethel Symes, Hardin's grandmother. I'd heard of Nick Boddy, of course, the fiery provocateur. I'd never listened to a Boddy broadcast or read one of his blogs. I'm not his demographic. But Bethel was a regular, and she was incensed that Hevner had made a piss storm, her words, of her grandson's murder, exposed her family's aching heart to the world. Because of Bethel, I tuned into the Hevner interview and subsequently launched the missiles that kicked off the feud. I never heard from Bethel Symes again. Agitated, I got out of bed did some questionable grooming, mostly teeth, then descended to the kitchen. After brewing coffee, I filled the bowl of my judgmental cat. Then I snagged the Observer from the back stoop and settled at the table to scan stories I'd already seen on the internet. Why the dinosaur approach to news? Loyalty to the kid who's been tossing papers onto my stoop for the past 3 years, winging them from his bike with NASA precision. Derek. Derek claims he's saving up to attend Harvard. Maybe I'm a sucker. The story also gets him a ridiculous holiday tip. A pileup on I-77 had taken the lives of an Ohio family en route to Charleston for their annual beach week. New condos were going up in Southend. The DOJ was opening an inquiry into the finances of a local member of Congress. Nothing on the faceless man, my real reason for looking. Another coffee, then I pulled my MacBook Air from my carry-all and ran a quick online search. Found no mention of the discovery of human remains near Charlotte. I puttered until 8, dishes, email, a load of laundry. Then, knowing he was a dawn riser, I dialed Hawkins' mobile. He answered after one ring.
"Shoot,"
Hawkins' normal greeting. "Is a thank you in order?"
"For what?"
"Did you text me last night?"
"Nope."
Surprised, I explained the photos. "Any idea who sent them?"
"Nope."
"Is the body at the MCME?
"Yep."
To say Hawkins is taciturn would be the understatement of the millennium. "What's the scoop?"
"Guy was pig feed."
I was guessing dogs. One glance at the texted images had told me the mutilation was due to animal scavenging.
"Wild hogs."
"Where?" When talking to Hawkins, I often adopt his brusque manner. Not a conscious choice, the clipped rhythm just sucks you in.
"Cleveland County."
I left an encouraging pause. As usual, the ploy didn't work. "Body dump?"
"Unclear."
"When did he roll in?"
"Yesterday."
"The autopsy will take place on Monday?"
"This morning. I caught it."
"It's Saturday. Why the urgency?"
"No idea."
"Who's doing the cutting?"
"Hevner."
"What do you know so far?"
"Stiff's got no face, no belly, no hands."
I could hear a television in the background. Hawkins was at home, wherever home was. In all our years together, I'd never asked where he lived. He'd never volunteered.
"So, no visual ID and no IAFIS?"
I was referring to the Integrated Automated Fingerprint Identification System, the FBI's national database of prints and criminal histories. Sometimes you're lucky and get a cold hit.
"Nope."
Unless the guy's carrying a license in his pocket, Hevner will need a bio profile to give to the cops.
"Social security card would do."
Clattering overrode the rise and fall of the TV dialogue. Hawkins was either cooking or building something. "I'll let you know if I hear from Hevner." Saying the words made my stomach curl in. I knew Dr. Morg would never call. She didn't. Not all morning while the autopsy was underway. At 10, I went for a long run, pushed myself hard, came back drenched and almost trembling with muscle fatigue. There was no voice message on my mobile, no flashing red light on my answering machine. I know, more Stegosaurus technology. There's zero reason for keeping the landline. No noble delivery boy, just habit. Like my old prescription meds, expired and useless but never thrown out. As the hours ticked by, I kept seeing the images. Kept asking myself who might have sent them. Came up with no plausible candidate or explanation. Hevner didn't phone at midday when she and Hawkins probably broke for lunch. Birdie was still pouting. Mama didn't check in to see if my head had exploded or ablaze with new travel ideas. Though each was the surviving spouse of a long-term marriage, she and the dry cleaning czar were planning the mother of all destination weddings. At least, Mama was. Ryan didn't ring with news from Montreal. Time was, I could always visualize Ryan's whereabouts. The Crime Contre la Personne squad room,
8 floors below my lab in the Edifice Wilfrid Jerome on Rue Parthenay. His condo at Habitat 67, all angles and glass, and views of the St. Lawrence River, view Montreal on the opposite shore. Since his retirement, another stressor for my curve, I can't pinpoint him with any precision. Slidell had also gone radio silent. Erskine Skinny Slidell, a combo of bluster and paunch and bad polyester, was for decades a detective with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department Homicide Squad, thus Ryan's equivalent in Dixie. Not in the sheets, just in the murder probes. Like Ryan, Slidell had also retired and shifted to PI work, though he continued as a volunteer with the CMPD cold case unit. I was never sure of Slidell's whereabouts lately either. I heard from no one, saw no trace of my cat. The annex was filled with a silence so total, I wondered if the previous week's migraine had caused a mini-stroke resulting in hearing loss. By 1 o'clock, I was suffused with enough manic energy to summit Everest solo. Okay, Brennan, showtime. Grabbing a Diet Coke and the laptop, I double-stepped up to the spiffy new addition. Light was slicing through the slats of the plantation shutters, the gray shutters that were supposed to be white. I made a mental note to phone my contractor first thing Monday. Cursed when I remembered he'd taken off for Puerto Rico to help his brother rebuild after Hurricane Maria. Revised note, call the painter. The air was infused with the sweet smell of freshly sawed wood. Okay, that was sort of nice. One of the two desks was new, the brainchild of some shishi designer who'd probably dubbed the style Italian modern chic. Slab of glass top, stainless steel legs. I'd found the stark lines jarring at first, had to admit the thing was growing on me. Two pictures hung above the gleaming glass, below the point where the new roof angled down to meet the new wall. Ryan, second from the right, top row, taller than most in his police academy graduating class. Ryan in a Sûreté du Québec officer's dress uniform, arm wrapping the shoulders of his daughter, Lily, now several years dead from a heroin overdose. Atop the gleaming glass, illuminated by an off-angle slash of daylight, a Canadian's bobblehead signed by Guy Lafleur. Beside the bobblehead, a lamp that looked like a twisted hunk of wing from a Nebulon frigate. I settled at the other desk, old and familiar, a flea market find the shishi designer would have labeled Salvation Army Reject. Wiring dangled from the ceiling and jutted from the wall above me, a stark reminder of the electrician, as incompetent and unreliable as the painter, the two phone confrontations that would brighten my Monday. Diplomas waited on my desktop, ready for hanging. Northwestern University MA and PhD degrees, an American Board of Forensic Anthropology Diplomate certificate. Beside the diplomas, framed photos sat on the patina-glazed oak. Mama and Daddy smiling over two blonde, plaited girls in pinafores. Pete and I holding an infant Katie. Ryan and I outside an auberge in the Quebec countryside. Larrabee and I on an AAFS panel. Daddy, Larrabee, both dead. Pete and I metaphorically so. The chronology of a shattered life? Christ, Brennan, give it a rest. Ryan and Slidell, retired and in partnership, PIs not cops. Hevner in charge and myself exiled from the MCME. The reconfiguration of my well-ordered world was blowing my arterially compromised mind. Call it a character flaw, a product of aging. I'd only owned up to the weakness in the past few months. I dislike change. Thus my reluctance to relocate to this new space. But I was here now, with everything related to the faceless man. New investigation, new era. The rest of my files and documents I would bring up piecemeal. Goaded by my irritation with Hevner, I opened the laptop, went to Google, and entered the name Hardin Symes. Not much came up, but enough. There was coverage of the child's disappearance and the massive search that ensued, the tragic outcome. All reports were consistent on the basics. 7-year-old Hardin Symes lived with his mother, grandmother, and two sisters in an apartment on East Indiana Avenue in Bismarck, North Dakota. On August 19, 2012, Harden was snatched while playing alone on the complex's front lawn. Neighbors reported seeing a dark-haired man forcing a child into a car. 5 days later, Harden's decomposing corpse was found by hunters, 15 miles from where he'd lived. A 2014 article in the Bismarck Tribune reported on the trial of Jonathan Fox, the suspect charged with Harden's murder. The defense argued that all the evidence was circumstantial and that public statements made by the ME had prejudiced the defendant. The jury ended up deadlocked, and the judge declared a mistrial. Of particular interest was a story that appeared on the 3-year anniversary of Harden's death. 17 months before Harden had been taken, 8-year-old Jack Jabernon had disappeared from his home in the same neighborhood. Jack's father said a dark-haired stranger had invited his son to a local park to catch frogs. Though he'd been warned not to go, the boy went anyway. That night, a family out hiking found Jack's beaten body in a forest 12 miles away. An autopsy showed he'd been strangled or smothered. The parallels were striking. The two boys had lived just blocks apart. They disappeared within a year and a half of each other. They were roughly the same age. Both were dumped in wooded areas at approximately the same distances from their homes. And, most telling, Jonathan Fox had rented a unit in the same apartment complex as Harden Symes's family. Though the Bismarck police were convinced they'd arrested the right guy, Fox was never retried. In 2015, the department's cold case homicide squad began sifting through boxes, looking for sufficient evidence to nail the bastard. I found no follow-up on the investigation. Apparently, nothing had come of reopening the file. I Googled Jonathan Fox, learned the following. Fox was a seventh-grade dropout who'd worked in Bismarck as a front desk clerk at a local motel. After being tried for the murder of Harden Symes, he moved to Baltimore. In 2016, Fox was convicted of killing Chelsea Keller. Chelsea was 10 years old. She disappeared from the front lawn of her home. Her body was found in a forest 18 miles away. In 2017, Fox was stabbed to death at the Western Correctional Institute in Cumberland, Maryland. I sat back, feeling a sharp warning twist in my gut. The same twist I'd felt when Hevner had run her mouth with body. In the end, Fox's ass had been slammed to the wall. But I'd been right. Hevner's remarks had been used by Fox's lawyer at trial, and the strategy had worked. But the gut twist had been triggered by something more than inappropriate comments about a murdered child. After checking some old notes in a filing cabinet in the downstairs guest room study, I Googled the name Nick Boddy and got the link to his radio show, Body Language. Once there, I clicked on the archive button and entered the date I'd just retrieved, September 4th, 2012. Reluctantly, I ponied up the required fee, answered the non-optional profile questions, then I opened the audio file. The interview was as I remembered. Boddy queried Hevner about her book, steering the conversation toward cases with the most gore and anguish. Hevner was an enthusiastic participant, her nasal whine almost as nauseating as Boddy's gravel through a sieve bark. 10 minutes in, Boddy jumped the lane and asked about Harden Symes. A momentary hesitation, then Hevner hopped on board, revealing details that should never have left the autopsy room, opining on the depravity of the doer. Then the betrayal that had shot my outrage into overdrive. 6 years on, it still did. Hevner told the world that Harden Symes had been autistic. The revelation allowed Boddy to segue to one of his favorite topics. Prearranged? Doesn't matter. The disclosure was wrong, a violation of professional ethics. Boddy spent the rest of the broadcast ranting about the evils of vaccination. His reasoning followed the usual two-pronged path of stupidity. He denied there was any scientific proof of a causal connection between vaccines and the reduction or eradication of diseases such as smallpox, polio, measles, or rubella, and he spewed the usual idiocy that vaccination can cause autism. Hevner, a medical doctor, offered no objection. Hevner's disclosure about Hardin-Symes was improper and callous. She hurt Hardin's family. She compromised the prosecution of his killer. Hevner's failure to contradict Boddy's anti-vax tirade gave credence to the ludicrous, to the dangerous. These were offenses I could not accept. I spoke out. Still nothing by 4. Screw it. Agitated as hell, I grabbed my keys and headed for my car. The MCME facility is located on Reno Avenue, just west of uptown. Saturday afternoon traffic was light. I was there in 10 minutes. Upon arriving, I knew that something was up. The parking lot held too many vehicles. A couple of vans had logos for local TV broadcast affiliates. Neurons sending out a low-level buzz, I swiped my security card and drove through the gate. Chapter 4. Margot Hevner was standing on the steps of the MCME building, steps I'd mounted countless times. I watched her, shocked and dismayed. Dr. Morg was dressed in aquamarine surgical scrubs. Fresh from a postmortem? Or for the iPlea TV doc optics? Journalists were thrusting boom and handheld mics at Hevner. Not many, 5 in all. She was finishing a prepared statement or answering a question. Male, 5'8", medium build, possibly Asian. Hevner's hair and makeup looked suspiciously good for someone coming straight from an autopsy. Age? Asked by a bored-looking reporter from WSOC, the local ABC affiliate. Not old, not a kid. That describes more than half the population. Wisecracked by a freelancer who looked like a lizard, if a lizard could squeeze into size 40 short cargo pants. I'd met him, Jerry something. The body exhibits advanced putrefaction and severe animal damage. Like what? Rats? Unlike my paperboy, Jerry wouldn't be going to Harvard. Feral hogs, Mr. Bruger. Adding, as though fearful she might not be believed, they're a huge problem in North Carolina. Feral hogs? Fessy Green. 5 minutes out of Clemson and working the Observer crime beat. Green sounded like she'd soon be the color of her surname. Pigs gotta eat. These pigs chose to eat a corpse. Hevner pointed to a chinless elf who weighed maybe 12 pounds.
What do you mean, possibly Asian?
The features are ambiguous.
Meaning what?
The elf was persistent. Hevner's finger went to a bright young thing from Fox 46. Will Dr. Brennan be working the case? My office is in contact with local, state, and federal authorities. Together, we will get this unfortunate gentleman identified and returned to his loved ones. The adrenal buzz gave way to heat, a flush that crawled up my throat and spread across my cheeks.
How'd the guy die?
Jerry. I'm not at liberty to discuss cause of death.
You thinking murder? Suicide?
Same answer.
You organize this party. What can you discuss?
My office will provide further information as it becomes available. Hevner hesitated, probably for effect. Then doing earnest and forthright, in the interest of the soonest possible closure, there are a few details I'm willing to share. My fingers tightened on the car keys forgotten in my hand. Oddities that might mean something to someone reading or hearing about them. Jerry tried to interrupt. Hevner ignored him. The man carried no credit cards, license, or any form of identification. He had no wallet, but a roll of cash totaling over $200. The only other item in his possession was a can of Swedish chewing tobacco, brand name Göteborgs Rapé. His shoes appear to be of European origin. His clothing is high-end. The shirt is ecru linen with small ivory buttons. The pants are tan, a wool cashmere blend. The boxers are made of high-quality black silk. A pregnant pause, a nuanced gaze. The labels had been removed from every garment. The tobacco can yielded not a single print.
The roll of cash was made up of both euros and dollars. Hevner awaited their eager reaction. They only stared at her, confused. Then the elf launched a somewhat listless volley of questions. Others tagged along.
The labels were cut off?
That appears to be the case.
What's that mean?
I don't know.
Why no prints on the can?
I don't know. The outer surfaces are smooth, and the can was protected from the elements inside a pants pocket.
Did the man die where his body was found?
I can't comment on that at this time.
Why not?
If the guy was mugged, why leave the $200?
Why indeed?
How do you get out to this creek?
That, too, is a mystery. Thank you for your patience. Hevner flicked a wave, turned, and disappeared through the glass doors at her back. The Fox 46 reporter spoke into a camera, probably handing over to her anchor. My bullshit monitor was banging like a kettle drum. Hevner had called a presser. Before I'd arrived, she'd explained where the body was found. Was she really engaging the media in the hope someone would come forward? Was I again being paranoid, misjudging her motives? Or were my instincts correct? The grisly allure of feral hogs and a faceless corpse. The high drama of missing labels and strangely absent prints. Was Dr. Morgue at it again? Had her performance been Act One in a limelight grab leading up to a new book launch? Screw that. Ignoring a voice screaming that this was a bad idea, I entered the front door, dropped my purse in my office, threw on a lab coat, and hurried through additional security and down the bio vestibule to the large autopsy room. One table was occupied. I crossed to it and drew back the blue paper sheeting covering the body. The faceless man lay naked on the stainless steel, his flesh jarringly pale under the cruel fluorescence. Wasting no time, I pulled my iPhone from my pocket and, beginning at his head and working toward his feet, started snapping pics. When I'd finished with the corpse, I moved to the counter and took a series of shots of the man's clothing and belongings. Then I laid down my phone and pulled on latex gloves. Hawkins arrived as I was digging a swab kit from a drawer. He looked his usual zombie self, tall and skeletal with dead black hair, oiled back from a face centering on a bony nose, gaunt cheeks, and wire-thin lips. I couldn't have guessed his age, 60? 80? For years, the joke at the MCME was that Hawkins had died in the 80s and no one had noticed. Cocking one quizzical brow, Hawkins watched without comment as I scraped a sample from the open thorax of the faceless man. "You really didn't text me pics of this guy?" I asked, voice low. "Nope." "Any idea who might have sent them?" Hawkins wagged his head no. "Who had access to him?"
"A few folks."
I knew that was true. I'd been running through a mental Rolodex of suspects. An MCME pathologist, another death investigator, a first responder at the scene, a tech manning the transport vehicle, the kids who discovered the body. But none of those felt right, and the sender had to be someone with access to my mobile number.
"Appears the boss lady's angling for a spot on Dateline." Hawkins also spoke mezza voce.
"Not if I can block her." Placing the swab in a tube,
"Maybe I can smoke out your mole."
"You'll ask around?"
"Diplomatically."
I glanced at Hawkins. "I don't want to jam you up."
"Won't happen."
I'd barely tightened the vial's cap when a voice spoke at our backs, nasal and whiny. As I slipped the sealed specimen into my pocket, Hawkins discreetly palmed my mobile from the counter. We both turned. I forced myself to smile. "What are you doing here?" Hevner was wearing an expression like she just soiled her Gucci's in dog shit. "I was driving nearby and caught the start of your press conference." Not wanting to out whoever had sent the text. "Hearing you had a decomp, I diverted over." "My understanding is that you consult to this office only upon specific verbal or written request." "Dr. Larrabee and I..." "I am not
Dr. Larrabee.
I said nothing.
Do you seriously think this office cannot function without you, Dr. Brennan? That I am incapable of determining when specialty expertise is required?
Our eyes met for a long, cold moment.
Should I require your services, I will contact you. Now please leave.
I did, chest burning as though I'd just run a marathon.
As I walked to my car, Paulette Youngman's words came zinging from long ago. The ant always loses. I just entered the annex when my landline rang. After checking caller ID, I picked up the handset.
Sweetie, are you all right?
Mama, vowels broader and more honeyed than Scarlet at Terra. Of course, I'm all right.
Why aren't you answering your mobile?
I'm having battery issues. True, but unrelated to her query.
Where are you?
Home.
Are you feeling poorly?
Not at all. I'm going out later. Regretted as soon as the words left my lips. Surprisingly, Mama didn't pounce.
Sinich arrived today.
Mama's fiancé was named Clayton Sinich. For some reason, she never used his first name.
He'll be here until Wednesday.
That's nice.
I suppose so.
Wistful, begging me to inquire. I didn't. Do you two have big plans?
I must do something about the man's feet.
His feet.
They smell like soup made from dirty shorts.
No way I was touching that.
I'm thinking I should buy one of those foot odor products they sell at the grocery, maybe shake some into his shoes when he's in the shower. You'd think soap and water would resolve the situation. He's in there now, splashing away. One upside to showering is it gets him naked.
Snapshot image I'll never unsee.
Sinich is a lovely man, but some days I still do miss your daddy.
I know, Mama. So do I. My early childhood was a happy time. I wasn't abused or bullied or made to adhere to a set of crazy strict religious mores. I never broke a bone, needed surgery, stitches, or counseling. My sister Harry and I got along reasonably well. Mama suffered from what would now be called bipolar swings. She'd disappear into rehab for periods, but always came home. Then my baby brother died of leukemia, and it all went to hell. Mama fell into a dark place that she couldn't escape for years. Daddy turned to drinking hard, ended up dead on a highway in the family Buick. Decades later, I still missed my father terribly.
I called because I'm lying in bed and just watched some very interesting television.
Mama's tone dropped to a confidential half-whisper.
You working on this corpse got gnawed by hogs?
Point of information. My petite gray-haired mother has a mind like a spaghetti bowl highway interchange. Conversations with her swoop and diverge, sometimes loop back, sometimes don't. We were now on the subject of my work, which for some reason fascinates her. Additional POI. Regardless of the momentary off or on-ramp, Mama can home in on evasion like a night vision drone. I didn't bother dodging this question. Apparently not, I said.
Is that dreadful woman still causing you grief? What's her name?
Margot Hevner.
Why on earth is she so hateful to you?
Years ago, I offended her.
How? Poisoned her parakeet? Spit in her grits?
Does it matter?
Yes, she said firmly. I laid it all out. Harden Symes, the body interviews, the revelation about Harden's autism, Hevner's failure to counter body's anti-vax insanity, my calling her unprofessional. While I was talking, Birdie padded into the kitchen, sat, and fixed me with a contemplative gaze. Either that or he was hungry. Choosing to interpret the cat's appearance as a gesture of rapprochement, I got up and filled his bowl, with the canned stuff he prefers, not the dry crunchers. He sniffed, then stretched to show his indifference. As I turned away, he abandoned the theater and eagerly dived in. When I'd finished my story, Mama's reaction was quick and severe. I can forgive the man, his flat-out stupidity. Lord knows he can't help the IQ he's been dealt. But Nick Boddy is mean-spirited, unprincipled, and vile as a snake. You listen to his show? Surprised.
I listen to everything.
But if you don't like him,
I need to be aware of the foolishness flying loose in the world.
I said nothing.
I once heard Boddy go full out about the government training up cats for mind control. Can you believe that?
My eyes drifted to Birdie. I believed it.
Another time, he was off to the races on white genocide, saying immigration, miscegenation, birth control, and abortion are being used to cause white people to go extinct.
Used by whom?
He was a bit vague on that. Not to mention population genetics. The man is completely ignorant of scientific facts. He doesn't believe in climate change, insists global warming is a sinister hoax, like the moon landing and fluoridation of the water supply.
I tried to change the subject. Mama was on a roll.
Did you know that the little weasel rarely shows his face in public? No one knows where he lives or what he does when he's not contaminating the airwaves with his drivel.
I've read that.
He spews his hogwash, then transmits the files through servers in Bosnia, Borneo, Belarus, and who knows where else, so that the original IP is untraceable.
Final POI. My mother is a crack-bang genius with computers and manipulation of the World Wide Web. Partly my doing. When she was in one of her funks and checked into a rehab facility, I bought her a laptop to engage her mind. To my surprise, she jumped onto the internet with gusto, subsequently enrolled in and completed scores of courses on various cyber skills. Now there's no stopping her. I glanced at the clock. 5:20 p.m. Mama, I should go. I could picture the tightening at the corners of the Dior-tinted lips then. Darling, here's my counsel. Take it or leave it. You say Hevner had no scruples about wagging her chin with this circus clown fool of a blowhard. You say she's now blocking you from a job you've been performing for decades. Do it anyway.
Sorry? Beat Hevner at her own game. If you're feeling up to it, that is.
Her own game? I was lost.
Good Lord, Tempe, you're brilliant, but you can be thick.
Mega patient sigh. ID the faceless man on your own. If you succeed, it'll irk the patootie out of your new boss, maybe impress the big enchilada in Chapel Hill.
But an investigating will give you something to do besides stewing at home all day.
As long as it won't compromise your condition, of course.
Nope. Didn't touch that.
You still there?
I am.
The shower cut off. I should spritz myself up. You'll consider what I said?
Yes. Anything to avoid thoughts of Clayton Sinich fadoodling my mother.
Consider it I did, turning and twisting the idea a zillion different ways. Accept my fate and focus my professional energies elsewhere? Fact is, I get plenty of requests, though to be honest, not enough to fill the financial gap left by my loss of income at the MCME. I still drew a salary for my teaching at UNCC and payment for my consulting to the Laboratoire de Sciences Judiciaires et de Médecine Légale, the LSJML, in Quebec. But the purchase of the Montreal condo and the cost of construction at the annex had me stretched pretty thin. Ryan would help, of course, but there was no way I'd allow him to pay more than his share. More stressors for the curve.
So, follow Mama's suggestion and forge ahead with the faceless man on my own?
Clearly I was already invested. Otherwise, why had I taken the photographs and blood sample? In addition to Hawkins, I had at least one other ally. But who was the anonymous texter?
And why had he or she sent me those images? Going rogue could turn out to be the final career slayer on my home turf. On the other hand, what did I have left to be slain? At 5:40, I grabbed the handset and dialed Chapel Hill. The office of the chief medical examiner was closed for the day. Of course it was. I left a voicemail for the big enchilada. By 6, I was fizzing to the fingertips with agitation. Finally, the call I was expecting. An hour later, I was sitting in a back booth at Sassy's Chili Shack, a grubby 50s-style diner behind a patch of weedy gravel on Wilkinson Boulevard. Sassy's looked like it might have started life as a Hell's Angels clubhouse. The patrons looked like card-carrying gang members or wannabes, shaved heads, flamboyant facial hair, sleeveless denim, lots of leather, studs, and dangling keys. You get the picture. Though I like dives, Hawkins's go-to spot is not my fave. The dump smells of cigarette smoke and beer-marinated wood, and the menu offers little but chili and cue. Hawkins sat across from me, looking like an upright cadaver in glasses. He was working a combo plate involving a lot of dead animals. I was sipping a Perrier with lime, an eyebrow razor with the tattooed and bearded barman. An eco-friendly Harris Teeter sack lay on the table between us, the parrot-green fabric discordant in the murky light. Inside it, I could see the top of a large brown envelope, a rectangular bulge I hoped was my phone. I let Hawkins finish eating before asking if he'd floated queries about the mysterious texture.
"Gotta be cagey," he said, meaning no.
"What's in the bag?" Unable to control my curiosity a second longer.
"Copy of Hevner's file."
"Holy shit. Seriously?"
"Calm down. It's just the prelim. Nothing finalized."
"What's your take?"
"I'm thinking suicide."
"Why?"
"No trauma. No signs of a struggle. Vic lying straight, except for the work of the hogs, I'm saying."
"No note?"
"Nope."
"Hevner leaning that way?"
"She wants a murder."
"Did she run a talk screen?" Not questioning the odd comment.
"Standard only."
"Where was the body found?"
"Cleveland County, near Earl, a hop north of the state line."
"Why'd Charlotte catch the case?"
"Guess the locals didn't feel up to the challenge. No face, no hands, no gut."
"Rural area?"
"Mostly farmland and woods."
"The Cleveland County Sheriff worked the scene?"
"Such as it was."
"Who found the body?"
"Couple kids figuring to fish. Guess that won't be high on their list for a while."
Effusive for Hawkins, maybe a record. "How'd he get there?" Hawkins shrugged and lifted both hands, a move that made me think of a praying mantis. "Was any vehicle parked in the area, bike, motorcycle?"
"Not that I heard."
Hawkins knocked back the dregs of his coffee and flicked a finger at the bag.
"Photocopied what I could."
"I can't thank you enough."
"Your phone's in there, too."
"I owe you."
"Gotta keep it on the down low. Subterranean."
The cadaver eyes locked onto mine.
"No way it came from me."
"No way," I said. Chapter 5. Back behind the wheel, in the patch of gravel hosting nothing but old beaters and tricked-out bikes, I checked my watch, which was hard to read in the slanty amber-violet of early dusk. 8:02. Too early for my dinner date, too late to go home. The Harris Teeter bag lay on the passenger seat, taunting me with its purloined intel. I lifted a handle and dug out my phone and the brown envelope, which felt disappointingly thin. Unsealing the flap with one index finger, I slid free the collection of paper-clipped sheets and flipped through them. Photocopies. An incident report from the Cleveland County Sheriff's Department, a morgue intake form, case designated MCME 304-18, preliminary autopsy notes, very brief, a few crime scene pics. A speed read of the doc suggested that, lacking some fine citizen stepping forward, hope of an ID was as bleak as I'd feared. I scooped the swab kit tube and a Sharpie from my purse and added the case number. Through the clear plastic, I could see the white wadded gauze with its plastic dowel. I hadn't initialed the tube's small white cap, normal protocol for a tech collecting a sample. Ignoring the alarm again pinging in my brain, I returned the envelope and the tube to the bag and headed out. Several zip codes later, I pulled into a small shopping center in a far more privileged section of town. Wine shop, nail salon, mom-and-pop brokerage firm. Tasteful lanterns oozing warm yellow onto well-behaved flora in window boxes and stone-sided planters. I parked outside a tiny walled courtyard outfitted with scrolly wrought iron tables and chairs. A sign on the brick announced Barrington's in hushed script. I crossed the courtyard and entered through a bell-tinkling door. The sole commonality between Barrington's and Sassy's was the presence of food. Okay, and dimness. At the chili joint, the low lighting was due to cutting corners on utility bills. At Barrington's, the candles and sconces were carefully orchestrated for gastronomically appropriate ambiance. My fellow townsmen love to make lists of the Queen City's finest. The best microbreweries, the top gyms, the tastiest noodle shops. My colleague and friend Lizzie Greiser is a Charlotte expat living in Virginia. Lizzie keeps up with local news and takes such reviews seriously. Thus the night's venue. In the category of fine dining, Barrington's regularly blows the competition out of the skillet. The restaurant has only 14 tables, all of which are filled most nights. When Lizzie finalized the date for her bi-monthly pilgrimage south, she phoned immediately. That booking had taken place in mid-May. The hostess led me to a two-top deep in one corner. I just hooked my purse strap and the handles of the Harris Teeter bag over the seat back when Lizzie arrived. How best to describe Dr. Elizabeth Lizzie Greiser? She checks all the boxes that should make her pretty by 21st century Western standards. Bright hazel eyes, full lips, button nose that turns up just the right amount at the tip. Somehow, the combination doesn't quite work. Instead, her features seem painted on a canvas oversized for proper scale. Lizzie is older now. Her eyelids droop and her jawline sags a little. But she's not unattractive, far from it. She's just, well, odd. My friend dropped into the seat opposite mine, which made her appear shorter than her actual 5'9". Lizzie's frame is also a bit outside the curve, her legs contributing far more than their share to her height. Am I late? Just got here. I smiled, maybe a little too broadly. Nerves? The pinging id? How's your mother? Makes me wish I'd taken a job in Missoula. There's a lab in Missoula? I could start one. Get me a hat and a bandana, screw cowboys while wearing my boots. But wait, isn't Montana the state that elected that jerk to Congress, the one who body slams reporters? In its defense, the place has a lot of big sky and must be far cooler than here. Damn. The Loot Desert must be cooler than here. Look, Tempe, I'm not a gusher, but I really appreciate your taking an interest in Mom. Your visits are truly above and beyond. It's just around the corner from my townhouse. Not exactly. And she's an interesting lady. She's 99 and thinks I'm still in school. Lizzie completed her doctorate in molecular biology in 1972. When I hit the local forensic scene, she was working in serology at the CMPD crime lab. One winter day, we shared a tuna salad sandwich and a laugh over the peculiarity of names. Lizzie's mother was called Temple. Tempe, Temple. We found the coincidence funny. Over the years, Lizzie and I consulted on dozens of the same cases. Though she was at least a decade my senior, a guess, she'd never say, the collegial camaraderie morphed into friendship via dinners, movies, and shared tales of parental woes. Eventually, Lizzie's father died, and her mother began to forget how to brush her teeth, find the pharmacy, use the remote. Temple Greiser was currently a resident at Sharon Towers,